This episode of the Sit Down is powered by Thrive Fantasy. Are you into props? Do you like betting fantasy football? Are you ready for football? Thrive Fantasy has you covered. With Thrive, you can eliminate the countless hours of research and focus on only the top tier athletes that have the biggest impact on the game. Who the hell wants to worry about bench warmers and that kind of stuff? We can worry just about the top tier guys. And if you love props, this is definitely for you. What you do is you choose 10 out of the 20 available player props to build your lineup. Each prop is assigned a fantasy value for both the over and under based on how likely it is to hit. You hit the most props and you rack up the most points to win big shares of prize pools. Keep in mind, Thrive Fantasy has over 140,000 guaranteed in prizes for NFL Week 1. NFL Week 1 is coming. We're about a month away from the NFL season. And Thrive Fantasy wants to award you with over that and a ton of money as the season gets going. Thrive also features 100K guaranteed contests, and it's just $20 to enter, and first place takes home $20,000. I urge you, if you enjoy the Sit Down, if you enjoy football, go check out a brand new app, Thrive Fantasy, and if you use promo code Sit Down when you sign up today, you're going to get 100% instant deposit as a bonus. Up to $100. So if you put up $100, they're going to give you $100 and you can play that for free on Thrive Fantasy. If you like player props, I love player props. It's the sport app for you. Don't do the general, just fantasy apps. Go check out Thrive today. Get in the game. Again, promo code Sit Down when you sign up today and you receive 100% instant first deposit match up to $100. Get involved. Thrive Fantasy.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, an organized crime podcast. I am your host, Jeff Nadeau. As always, we are back with another show. It is, well, we're past actually at this point, Labor Day weekend. The unofficial end to summer is here, and you know, now we start to kind of turn the clocks a little bit. It's always a different feel in the air once Labor Day gets here. Feels like we were just starting this show at kind of the beginning of spring, and now we're almost into fall, and we continue on here, episode 23. Michael Jordan episode is here. We got a great one today. We're going to talk about Frank Matthews, and we alluded to who Frank Matthews was last week. And I got to tell you, I'm pretty excited for this one. I really think Frank Matthews is a pretty incredible story. I've always been infatuated with him and his story. So I'm excited to talk about it, really get you to know really the probably the largest scale drug dealer in the history of America and really kind of how he got away with it and got past everything. We'll do that in a bit. We've got a Q&A to get to as well. Let's bring in our co-host, the great Black Jack Fletcher, our consigliere, a friend of ours. How you doing, Black Jack? Good to have you back. Another week, another show.
That's it, baby. That's it. I am fantastic, as always. Excited to do something a little bit different this week, talking about Frank Matthews, kind of a little bit of a left turn from what we normally talk about. But it's good to mix it up every now and then, brother. You know, you gotta fit all types into this show. So I'm excited to talk about the man they called Black Caesar.
Yeah, I am too. And, you know, we've done Kabani Savage. We talked about him and his exploits. We talked, I mean, episode 3, I think it was, we did the Philadelphia Black Mafia. And we'll talk about them a little bit today just with who Frank Matthews was. But, you know, Frank Matthews really is an interesting guy because he had a lot of, you know, negative interactions with the American Mafia. And we'll really talk about kind of the kind of guy he was and how at one point you could make the case that what the American Mafia was doing, they were doing stuff that Frank Matthews was doing and they couldn't do. So we'll get into all that and more. I'm really excited. Q&A, we'll get to that. We've got some good questions. I first want to ask you, though, football is here, Blackjack. How was your first week? How did everything get on? We've got NFL starting in a couple of days. This is a great time to be alive. And look, with the connotation of gambling and the Mafia, we've always kind of, they're all kind of one. How was your first week?
It was good, Jeff. It was good. I was very happy. You know, I had that Penn State game. I had Michigan State outright. You know, if BYU would have covered it, would have been a little bit better. But otherwise, it was a good first week. And it's just – it's so nice to have football back. I mean, we've got, you know, Tampa Bay and Dallas kicking off the season tomorrow in the NFL. And it just kind of gives structure to your week again, right? It's like, all right,
yes,
the NFL on Monday, Thursday, Sunday – we've got college football a few days during the week. It just, there's a structure to it that I just like.
That is so true. It's so, so true. I've always said that once Labor Day gets here, it feels like life is a bit normal. Summer always, when I was a kid and really into my, you know, adult years even, it was always kind of a mess. You know, you weren't at school or you, yep. you were spending a lot of time at the shore or at pools or whatever. And there's just no real structure. Once kind of Labor Day comes, people go back to school, you start, you're kind of having a regular schedule. It gets dark earlier. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of the end. And I'm excited. We kind of have a structure here with the show, but football is so great. And I'm so happy it's back. It's going to be terrific.
And with fans, Jeff, watching that Virginia Tech UNC game with that crowd,
yes.
You know, screaming Enter Sandman at the top of their lungs. We haven't seen that in almost 2 years.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, it just seems all of a sudden like, you know, obviously there's still some, you know, COVID issues out there, but, you know, it seems like we're starting to live with it. You know, we're starting to move on and it's all great to see. But let's get into the show. Q&A time. We always get great questions and we've had some really great ones. People, it's nice to do this because it really kind of allows people to get their questions answered. Maybe a question that they've wondered about. It really gets us thinking, right? With some of the things that we see all the time in the mafia and different organized crime. So let's kind of get into it here. First one out of the gate. I was born and raised in Vermont. Was there ever a mafia presence in the woods of our state? Not that I know of. Look, were there some hanger-ons or some associates from the Patriarchas or parts of you know, the Angiulos or the Bulgers? Maybe. I know that one of the synonymous things with the Boston area would be Charlestown and some of the bank robberies that were going on with yep. Anthony Shea and some of those people. Did they bleed into Vermont? I would imagine. I'm sure there was some connections through Canada and things of that nature, but there was no organized, like we see like these defunct crime families in certain areas. None that I know of. I do know there is some kind of street gang stuff going on up there. You can find street gangs in really every state in America, even in Vermont. So, you know, Vermont, I wouldn't say that. Maine, I wouldn't say that either. New Hampshire, probably. But as far as Vermont's concerned, none that I know of. All right, this is a good question, Blackjack. You get to make a mob movie. You can pick any past or present mobster. It can be their whole life or just one thing they did. Who is the movie about and who do you cast as the main player? This is a great one. And I'll give you my two and then we'll kind of hear from you. I'll let you think for a second. I'm going to do two people, you know, two different subjects, but I think two movies that really need to be made. One of them would be on our subject today, Frank Matthews. I think he has a story that is made for a movie. I think a great character to play him, Idris Elba. I think he'd be terrific. Kind of looks like Frank Matthews a little bit. I think he could pull it off. We've obviously seen him play gangsters in the past and you know, The Wire and things of that. So I would say Frank Matthews. And I would also say Joey Merlino. I've said that before. I think him and his group would kind of be a fascinating film. Michael Imperioli would play a great Joey Merlino. Yeah. What about you? Do you have anybody?
That's a really tough one because, you know, there have been so many movies made that touch on a lot of
different
people. You know, I would probably want to see a movie. Again, Jeff, I obviously the New York guys are the top of the heap as far as American mafia goes. But I'm always really intrigued by Meyer Lansky because even though he's not technically a made man, Meyer Lansky had so much to do with the founding of Las Vegas and making it what it is today. And again, you mentioned Michael Imperioli. I think he could play him. Even though Meyer Lansky was Jewish, I think Michael Imperioli could play him.
I could see that, actually. And you know, I'll have to ask. I mean, did you see the Lansky film that came out this year?
I did, Jeff, and I didn't love it. You know, I find so often with a lot of the mob movies now that are coming out that I don't have the same link to them that I do the ones that came out, you know, in the 80s and 90s.
It just seems like they like make them so lame. Like they, yeah. There's always some stupid, goofy part of it. And really, look, I know people will say what they want about The Irishman, but The Irishman was made recently. And it was definitely on another level over like the Lansky film, that god awful Capone film they put out. You know, but you know, again, we know why that is, because Scorsese, De Niro, Pesci, and Pacino were involved. But you're right. It would obviously have to take a lot. I do know, and we've talked about it, there are some things in the works. I know there's a Mafia Cops thing coming out. Terrence Winter's doing it. He was part of Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire. And I know there's some Greg Scarpa stuff coming out down the road. And, you know, obviously we have the Gotti film that's going to be made. But, you know, you're right. It's really hard to find a valid, good film about the mob now. It just seems so tacky and kind of lame. I do like Keitel. I think he's a good actor, but it just didn't do a whole hell of a lot for me personally.
No, I agree.
But a great question nonetheless. Blake Smith, how powerful, influential was Russell Bufalino? The Irishman portrays him as a top player involved with high-level hits, Anastasia, Gallo, and I know there's a lot of liberty taken in the story. Yeah, look, it's that simple. He had nothing to do with Joe Gallo. He had nothing to do with Albert Anastasia, as far as I know. Was he powerful? Sure. Was he powerful to the level of what they made him out to be in The Irishman? No. He did have a lot of connections, though, in the unions and labor rackets. He was very powerful up in his area, and he was part of the commission. I mean, he was a guy that had an ear to Angelo Bruno. He obviously knew Frank Sheeran, who, again, I know they would lead you to believe Frank Sheeran was a nobody, but he wasn't. He was a guy that had a lot of power in the unions and knew Jimmy Hoffa. You know, Russell Bufalino, the big thing for him was legal industry and legal business. I mean, he died a very rich man. Most of Northeastern Pennsylvania was in control of him, and most of Pennsylvania for that matter. So him and Angelo Bruno really kind of controlled the eastern half of Pennsylvania. And that kind of bled right into New York, where they were directly close with.
Yeah. There's a good book out on him, The Quiet Don. I don't know if you've read that, but it's worth a read.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And look, Russell died, you know, where you want to be if you're a mobster, in your own bed. And he did very little prison time. He was very powerful. And, you know, interestingly enough, he actually married into the mafia as well. His wife was from a long lineage of Sicilian mobsters. So, you know, he was a powerful guy, had a lot of connections, had a lot of power, and again, was very close in the unions and that kind of stuff. So that part of the film was very true. And he was at Apalachin as well, as far as we know. So he definitely was powerful. Gary Chalmers, did Tommy Gambino retire from the life when he got out of prison in 2000? As far as I know, Tommy Gambino is still alive. He's in his 90s, if you can believe it. I know that other sons of Carlo have died. And if you know anything about Tommy, he was involved heavily in a lot of different rackets, ended up going to prison, as the individual said, in the late 90s. With some white collar fraud and that kind of thing. What was a wholesale mobster? I mean, he did everything. As far as I know, he is still, they're pretty wealthy. As far as I know, the government didn't take everything. He's still around and he's still kicking very late into his life. You've got to be crazy to think that someone named Gambino, at least at that level, when it comes to Tommy, is still involved. He's an old man at this point. As far as I know, he is not involved in life anymore. What do you think the trajectory of the mob is if Lucky Luciano isn't locked up by Thomas Dewey? This is an interesting question, but I think it was kind of like the prohibition question last year. If not for prohibition, would the mob have been, you know, the same thing? I mean, let's remember, Lucky, you know, did a lot of stuff way after he was arrested by Thomas Dewey with the prostitution stuff.
Yep.
So I don't. I mean, what do you think? I don't think it would have changed too much.
I think you hit the nail square on the head when you compared it to the prohibition question last week, because I don't think the trajectory changes. I think that, you know, like you said, it's not like Lucky went away forever and he was never heard of again. So I don't think that anything really changes substantively in terms of the trajectory of organized crime.
Yeah. And look, I try to not, you know, when we haven't went over someone yet, I try to not go too much in them because it just takes away from the show we're going to do. But the Lucky show is coming. We try to space this stuff out. We've got a kind of a decently big announcement coming up that, you know, I think it's going to take the show to another level. So we're definitely going to get into Lucky. And we're going to dispel some myths as well. There's a lot of myths about Lucky Luciano, you know, as far as. And I'll just say one quickly. Nobody called him Lucky. Nobody. Okay. No one. They called him Charlie. They called him Charlie Lucky. Nobody called him Lucky. There's a lot of rumors, a lot of innuendo. We've got to get to him. We've got to dispel of. And that's what this show is going to do. We'll definitely talk about that. But yeah, I don't think it would have been too much because Lucky was still very much involved in the life way after the fact. So I don't know that it would have mattered a whole hell of a lot, to be real honest.
No.
But an interesting question to ponder. During the height of the mafia, what other criminal organizations or gangs in the area had feuds or wars with them? Well, the subject of today's show, Frank Matthews, had a beef with the Italians, which we'll get into. They weren't very happy with Frank for a long time. We obviously have talked about the Russian mob with Reznikov, with Casso and Merit Balagula. We obviously mentioned that briefly. You know, I guess we could say Mickey Spillane, but that didn't really matter too long because they were kind of, they took him out and ended up partnering with the Gambinos anyway. Not really that many groups, organizations beef with the Italians at one point. At one point, nobody fucked with the Italians. It's that simple. Now, we could talk about them fighting with each other, with the Colombo family, and, you know, over in Italy, they fight with each other all the time. But there's not really too many criminal organizations, at least during the heyday of the mob, that ever fucked with them, to be real honest. You had a couple like Frank Matthews and a couple others, but no one really went to create lengths to create feuds with the mob. The only people that did were the FBI. And whether you want to call them a criminal organization or not, that's up to you.
Yeah. In some instances, they absolutely are.
100%. This is a great question. How does a consigliere make money? Do they just get a whole percentage of the upstairs kick up, or do they have their own rackets like a capo, or does that vary family to family? You know, it's a question that's always kind of wondered. I don't think you really think about it, Blackjack. When you have the structure of the family, an associate kicks up to a soldier, kicks up to a capo, and a capo reports to the governing body. Now, where does that leave the consigliere? Because he's really acts as the counselor, the lawyer, if you will, the kind of purveyor. One thing that I will say to this, they definitely have people that kick up directly to them. They're almost a high-end capo regime, if you will. They're generally older people that have plenty of money coming in already, and it's really just a title they assume. But it's a question that we ponder because it's like, where does, you know, everyone kind of has a role, and the concierge is just kind of in his own role, but he has power, he has prestige, he already makes a ton of money, and it's really assigned for almost a fringe. And we talked about it with the Gambinos when Carlo was in control. Paul and Della Croce kind of were 1A and 1B underbosses. Now, one was a concierge and one was an underboss, but they both had a ton of power, and it seemingly didn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I would think, and this is just, you know, speculation, obviously, because like you said, we don't know for sure. If I'm the boss and I'm relying on my consigliere to give me sound advice, I probably want them to be loyal only or mostly to me, not to, you know, a racket that they're running on the street. Because what happens if that racket gets involved and now I need to ask him something and, you know, he's got divided loyalties. So I would assume that the kick up upstairs is where the consigliere would get most of his money from.
Now, and again, a lot of these guys already have been in the life for so long. They are trusted people. They're people that have a lot of wisdom and a lot of all that kind of thing. So there's plenty of money that they're already getting from rackets and that kind of thing. But it is an interesting question to ponder nonetheless. I would kind of relate it as they're the most respected higher end capo of the group. That's how I would look at it. Is there any way that the mob is still heavy handed with a stronghold on most things? No, not that I know of. There are some areas of cities and things that, you know, have a presence for sure. Is there any one racket that they control and no one else controls? Well, let's look at it. The bookmaking business, that's null and void in a lot of areas. Now, in most big cities, or let's say New Jersey, Philadelphia, New York, all these different places, bookmakers are not as important because people can go make regular bets. Is there still money coming in from bookmaking? Yes, but it's not enough to subsistently live on. Loan sharking, I guess there's still a little bit of a need for it. It's definitely not what it used to be. Nobody's shaking down businesses anymore. That's not going on. Is it happening isolating places? Yeah. Are they involved in the drug trade? Yeah. Do they control it? Hell no.
No.
You know, it's they're just not that big anymore. I hate to tell you. Are there guys that are doing things? Sure there are. Are the five families still around? Sure they are. But they're a lot more in the shadows. They have legit businesses. It's a little different than it used to. Now, if we go to Italy, they control everything. Okay. It's totally different. But, you know, to say that the Italian mob controls any trade at this point, particularly in the underworld, is not really true.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think that, like you said, are they still dealing drugs? Absolutely. Are they still probably involved in industries like construction and garbage? Yeah. But controlling it like they did in the 70s and 80s? No. No, that's not going.
It's not even close. So to answer your question, they don't control or heavy-handed in anything. Now, there are parts of New York that still have a presence, surely. Philadelphia, but, you know, there are other groups as well. Okay. I mean, it's just that simple. I recently was watching Vlad TV. What do you know about this Anthony Raimondi guy? I've looked him up and I can't find much about him. Is what he says true? I was waiting to get this question because this obviously is a sticking point right now in the mob genre. People have contacted me and asked me, what do I know about this guy? I did a video, I think at one point on YouTube, it was a live stream about this Raimondi character. As far as I know, none of what he says is true. As far as I know, I'll say this, and we've talked about this on the show before. There are a lot of informants and people that talk about the life that were involved with it, whether you believe them or not, whether you respect them or not. People like Gravano and A-Light and Gene Borello and Larry Mazin, all these different characters. They were all involved with the life. It's that simple, whether you like it or not.
Yep.
This guy, I have not found any sort of proof that he was ever involved with the mob. In fact, I've said before, all you need to do is go to Google and type in really virtually any mobster in the history of Cosa Nostra. And if they did anything, they'll most likely be noted and found. I also went to Gangland News, which Jerry Capisci runs. It's a great archived website. He reports news. I found nothing in there about this individual. None of what he says is backed up or corroborated. And, you know, this is a guy that claims he's related to Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky and all these different people.
I believe he claimed in one of your live streams that he was referenced in a newspaper article as John Doe.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's,
I don't know how that verifies your claim, but
again, it's from what I have found and what I understand about this cat is, these are all just made up stories and he's involving himself. If you notice any of the things that he talks about, every one of them involves someone that is dead. And no one can corroborate it. I am waiting for Franzese or Mazza to come out and talk about him because they were both in the Colombo crime family. And Raimondi claims to be involved at one point with Franzese's father. But I wouldn't believe if he told me that tomorrow was Monday at all. The guy's a complete fraud. He knows nothing. He wasn't involved in anything. And some of the stuff he says is just, it's not I mean, it's completely not factual. Blackjack, he made a comment one time that when he was 16 or something, he killed somebody and they sent him to MDC, okay? Which you and I both know, if you kill somebody, other than if it's involved in furtherance of a racketeering case or something like that, it is a state case. You know that, and I know that. Everybody knows that. And second of all, MDC wasn't open until 1975. It didn't even exist when he said he went to MDC. There's just little things that he doesn't know that he gets fucked up all the time. So no, you should not believe a fucking word that comes out of his mouth.
There you go.
Where's the Cosa Nostra most active? I'm guessing you are asking about America. Definitely New York. They're still the biggest. As far as in the world, Italy, 10,000%. Can you list your top five mob books? I can. The top five mob books, in my opinion, and again, these are my favorite, Black Brothers, Inc. by Sean Patrick Griffin. We had him on the show. Great book. Five Families by Selwyn Rabb. It's really, I think, the Bible of organized crime, at least on the mafia. Mob Files. It's a collection and an anthology of mob stories by George Anastasia. One of my favorites. One of my first mob books I ever got. It's awesome. Wiretap, which if you enjoy conversations and things of that nature, it's called Wiretap, Listening in on America's Mafia by James Good. Awesome. Absolutely terrific. It's just wiretap conversations. That's all it is. And I think probably the Holy Grail. And let's just be frank. I've read a few, probably 30 pages of this so far. And look, I am watching the show and I keep telling Blackjack how truly incredible it is. Gomorrah, which, you know, I don't want to go too deep just because I don't want to get on. I could probably talk for an hour about this. You know, Blackjack, I have myself while watching this show, I find myself saying to my inner being, is this quite possibly the greatest, not only TV show, but is this the greatest work of organized crime entertainment I've ever seen? It can't even be described. It's that incredible. And the book, obviously, it's based on real events. So I would highly recommend. How many times have I told you, Blackjack, you need to watch this?
I mean, at least twice a day for the last 5 days.
Hey, it's unbelievable. What can I say? Do you have any books you enjoy?
I'm with you. The two that stand out to me are Mob Files and The Five Families. Those are the ones that really, I think if you're looking to kind of get a sound knowledge base on the subject, read those.
Exactly. 100%. How did the mob divide up areas and rackets in New York? Did families have certain parts of the city? No. The cities had all sorts of families in them. Areas had all sorts of families. There was no like turf, that kind of stuff. And most families got along with other families. It wasn't like, you know, some of the street gangs where they beef with each other, Bloods, Crips, that kind of thing. It wasn't really like that. You know, you can go to the Bronx and you'll find all the crews represented, all the families represented. Just that simple. Final one. Who is the most overrated mobster? Do you want me to go or you want to go first?
You take this because I know you got a good answer.
John Gotti.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Look, I revere John. I think he was – I think when you look at the new age mob, I think he was the figurehead of it. But I think when we look back on his time, can we find anything he actually created or contributed other than negativity?
Yeah, it's –
I find trouble.
When we talked about this question, he's the only answer. You're very accurate in what you said. Like he's at the same time the most overrated and probably also one of my favorites because of his bravado and his, you know, arrogance in a way. Like the way he carried himself, it's such an iconic figure and personality, and there's so much of it that I love. But at the end of the day, did John Gotti accomplish anything other than accelerating the downfall of the American mafia? And I think the answer is no.
Yeah, and I mean, the definition of overrated is rated or valued too highly. And when you look at when just a common person talks about the mafia, the first person they're going to say is John Gotti or Al Capone. And the fascinating thing about both is both were, I mean, one of which wasn't even a mafia member. The other was very much overrated. He was a figurehead. He was a guy that everybody saw on the front of TV and newspapers and in the spotlight. But when we look back on his time, he really didn't do anything of that big a value. The only thing he really did was kill Castellano. And that was obviously ballsy and he took what he wanted, but he didn't follow the rules. He went against everything that was mafia. And I think really, as you said, was he the main reason? No, but he definitely didn't help it. You know, and
he accelerated it in a great deal because of his flamboyance and the way he taunted the federal government.
Right. And look, at the end of the day, you know, John was a gangster to his core. He did things that, you know, look, a lot of people aren't going to say, you know, I'm getting life and you're not going to hear me say a word. You know, he died choking on his own vomit. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know if there were a lot of overrated mobsters, to be real honest. They both on all carried. And look, I'll say one better, Blackjack. And I think when we look at this genre as a whole, could we actually talk in some episode about, was the mafia at one point, I mean, obviously, were they powerful in like the 50s, 60s? Sure. But are they overrated in general as a criminal organization, at least in this country?
I mean, I think you can definitely make that contention. I you know.
Because, I mean, compared to Italy, it's not even close.
No, it's not. Yeah. And I mean, the thing is that it's one of those, you know, examples of like, if you want to compare it to an athlete, I guess you'd use like a Gale Sayers, right? Like for the brief time when they were at the height of their power, you know, maybe a 20, 25 year span, were they incredibly powerful? Yes. But did it last? No, it didn't. I mean, it came to an end pretty quickly and pretty dramatically. So, you know, I think you could make that argument.
Yeah. And that's kind of a discussion. You know, and I think that would probably be like, if we ever had a final episode of this show, which I'm hoping we never do, but if we did, that would probably be a great episode. It was all history. But when we look back, I mean, I guess we'll just ask ourselves, I mean, are they comparable to a cartel? Are they comparable to, you know, the Ndrangheta or those groups? I mean, not really, but let's get into it. Let's move on. Great questions this week. Always get us thinking. And that's the important thing.
Yep.
Before we get into Frank Matthews, which I am very excited about, I want to tell you about Omerta Mia. Omerta Mia is a clothing brand. It is a lifestyle brand. And it is one that I have many articles of. I love Omerta Mia. And I think the biggest thing I love about it is it really fits kind of how I think. You know, I think the way I think, and maybe even Blackjack, the way he thinks, is really a lost art in our age group and the people below us. There's a certain way that I carry myself personally, and I'll teach my kids the same thing. And I like that Omerta Mia kind of stands with that. I think it's sickening that we glorify certain people the way we do, and their kind of values kind of align with where I am. And that's why I'm glad we're partnered with them. They have some great phrase shirts, wall art, hats, stickers, sweatshirts, really anything you'd want, coffee mugs. And they really feature some phrases that I think people can get behind. Nobody glorifies rats. Who wants to keep glorifying rats? We have to stop glorifying rats. The stuff is also well made. It's not going to fade after a wash or two. And they're a great family-owned brand. I highly urge you, go check out omertamia.com. A lot of people ask me, where'd you get the Omerta definition shirt or the Capone shirt? All I got was at omertamia.com. And if you go there right now, you're going to get a discount right at checkout. All you have to do is use code SITDOWN20. That's SITDOWN20, all one word. You're going to get 20% off your total purchase. You need to get with the program, you know, because a lot of us have the same values. You need to align yourself with those too. OmertaMia.com, promo code SITDOWN20. Blackjack, I know you're a big fan of Omerta Mia.
I love their stuff. I mean, it's well made, it's comfortable. And like you said, Jeff, you know, a man's got to have a code in life, whether it's, you know, the ones that they're espousing or not. But a man is nothing without a code, Jeff. So, you know, I like what they're promoting. I like their values and I like their stuff. So, yeah, go and put the code SITDOWN20 in, get 20% off, free shipping, and get some great stuff.
OmertaMia.com. All right, let's get into Black Caesar, Frank Matthews, on the sit down. Frank Larry Matthews was born February 13th, 1944, in Durham, North Carolina. Now, I want to kind of make people understand what Durham was and what it really was, really until present day. Durham, North Carolina was really the hub of Black culture at the time. If you go down to North Carolina, this was an area that was really, you know, powerful, frankly. Black business was a thing. It was something that in the community, it allowed Blacks to really elevate themselves. I mean, obviously, at the time, we were dealing with racism in this country, segregation. But in Durham, this was a place where Black Americans were thriving. They had something called the Black Wall Street. Durham was a hub for, you know, Black power, frankly, in the South. And, you know, when you look at Frank Matthews and really where he was from, it bred a lot of powerful Black individuals. I mean, you look at the high school Frank went to, it produced singers, it produced lawyers, it produced powerful people. And I think in Frank's graduating class, out of 350 individuals, I think 300 ended up going to college. Durham, North Carolina was the hub of the South for Black people. And, you know, Frank really grew up around that. His mother would die when he was really young. I mean, he was just a toddler when his mother died. He didn't know his father. And Frank would actually be raised by his grandmother and aunt. They kind of grew him up. They tried to keep him away from the streets. But in Durham, there were parts of it, like any city, that had their negative parts. And, you know, at an early age, Frank was known to be a smart kid. People would say that, you know, he had a business-like mind. And he was a small kind of kid. They called him Pee-wee in elementary and middle school. He was a little guy, but, you know, he had potential, I think, to a lot of people. He would drop out of school by the seventh grade and really would, blackjack by that point, resort to a criminal career. But, you know, a lot of people don't really understand that the hub of the South for the Black Renaissance really was Durham.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those towns. And, you know, Jeff, we've seen it, even as you said, in modern, more recent times, you know, with the, obviously, it's also the home of Duke University, with the Duke lacrosse scandal, right? And kind of the young woman who was involved with that. It is kind of a hub for Black culture in the South, especially in, you know, that part of the, it's kind of like the South Mid-Atlantic region. It's definitely one of those areas.
Yeah, a rich history, you know, as far as whether it's down in Winston-Salem or Durham or, you know, up in the Tidewater region of Virginia, you know, it's definitely got that history. And Frank was, you know, one of the many people that was from there. Frank would leave school and resort to kind of stealing things. Him and a group of kids in the area began stealing livestock from local farms. They would steal chickens and things of that nature and take them in and try to sell them for cash. At one point, Frank gets confronted by an angry farmer. He assaults the farmer with a brick, I believe, and gets jammed up. The cops find him in Durham on Canal Street and arrest him. He would be kind of slapped on the wrist, as far as I know. He'd get a year in a reform school in Raleigh. Once he got out of that, I mean, he's 16, 17 years old. He decides to leave Durham. And, you know, that's something that, you know, when you look at cities and kind of the Great Migration and that sort of thing, a lot of people, particularly in the drug game, were actually from North Carolina. If you go back and look, you know, a lot of drug dealers, Frank Lucas, Ike Atkinson, and Frank Matthews were all from North Carolina. This was something that we would see where, you'd go and you'd try to get a better life in the North, whether it was New York or Chicago or Philadelphia. Frank would leave and go up to Philadelphia, and he would start in the numbers business. He was trying to kind of create some connections up in North Philly, and he would meet some people, some important people. He met Major Coxon, who we'll talk about. Mage, the Mage was a guy that we're going to talk about a little bit here, but Major Coxon was kind of a power broker in the Philadelphia scene. He was big in South Jersey. At one point, the Mage, as they called him, was a nightclub owner, but he was a drug dealer as well. And he had a lot of connections. He was in kind of the black underworld, and he met Frank Matthews, and they kind of had become friends. And, you know, down the road, they would be obviously very good friends, and they would be a part of things for a long time. But, you know, Frank was meeting people, Blackjack, at the time that were important, particularly in the black community. This is where he would find his first run-ins with, you know, people from the black mafia. And Frank would start to wear out his welcome. He would get arrested in Philadelphia in 1963 and leave the town after the judge kind of levied and said, look, you're going to go away. Why don't you just get the hell out of here, leave our city, and we'll let you out of this.
That's a hell of an agreement. That's entirely unconstitutional, but I have no doubt that it's happened many, many times. You know, kind of a loser leaves town deal. It's a weird one, but he did. He went to New York.
Frank would learn how to cut hair and become a barber. He would go up to Brooklyn into Bedford-Stuyvesant and get into a local barbershop. Didn't last long, though. Frank obviously was a criminal. He enjoyed numbers, and he knew that there was a big city, a big bustling area for numbers, and his goal was to meet people that he could create and make connections with. He would get tired of cutting hair and the numbers business, but he would meet somebody that would kind of set the stage to his life, and that was a guy called Spanish Raymond Marquez. Now, if you listen to the Salerno episode, we talked about Marquez. Marquez was probably one of the biggest numbers runners in the history of Harlem. He was in Spanish Harlem, and he kicked up the Tony Salerno. As we remember, Salerno literally controlled Blackjack, the entire underworld in Harlem. And, you know, Raymond Marquez never directly was a business partner or anything, but he kicked up the Tony, and he was a big time guy. He made a lot of money, Spanish Raymond, and he really connected and made kind of a new life for Frank Matthews. Raymond Marquez was obviously close with the Italians. He knew Salerno. He knew people. And by this point, Frank Matthews, he's only 19, 20 years old. He realizes that heroin, cocaine, the drug trade is where I'm going to make a lot of money. And he wants to get connected with the French Connection, which at the time, when we look back on this, we have to say to ourselves, like, if think about this, this was a black teenager who said, I'm going to, in the 60s, go to New York, decide I'm going to start selling drugs, and I'm just going to try to connect him with the Italians. They literally laughed him out of there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very bold move to go and try to do, right? I mean, to go to a strange city and try to get hooked up with some of the most dangerous and powerful people in the drug trade. I mean, I guess you could say it's lucky for him that he knew Ray Marquez, because that kind of is his in.
It didn't work, though, because the Italian said, fuck no, we're not interested. Remember, at the time in the early 60s, Lucky, the Bonanno family, all the different gangs and groups there banded together. They created the French Connection. If we remember with the Galanti episode, the Italian mob controlled drugs in this country at that time. Okay. They were getting drugs sent from Turkey into Marseille, into France, then to Canada, and then through the Canada connections into the Bonanno family. And that was delved out through the United States. So obviously the mob was making a lot of money. The thing was, Frank wasn't going to give up. He uses Ray Marquez. He gets introduced to a guy called Rolando Gonzalez. He was a Cuban godfather. They called him El Padrino. Padrino, obviously, godfather in Spanish. He was a big, large-scale drug trafficker. He had international connections into Venezuela, which at the time was a big drug shipment area. The problem that he would run into, though, Gonzalez, was the feds were onto him. There was said that he had connections in the CIA. He gets jammed up in an indictment and flees and goes to Venezuela. But before he does that, he sells Frank Matthews cocaine. Frank buys his first kilo for 20 grand. Gonzalez kind of says to him, look, I'm out of here, but you're going to be the guy in New York now. I'm going to basically give you a key to fucking millions and a new life.
It's a hell of a deal, huh? I mean, if you think about it, he's buying his first kilo for 20,000, and all of a sudden the guy he buys it from leaves the country, leaves the continent, and now he's got this incredible opportunity in front of him where, you know, maybe you get the first key and you're trying to see what you can sell it for, how much money you can make. And now all of a sudden feels like the floodgates are open.
Yeah. And, you know, keep in mind, you know, Frank's into his 20s, you know, by the late, you know, mid to late 60s, the times are changing in New York. There's almost a black renaissance in Harlem. And if you went to Harlem during that time, there was money everywhere. You know, Harlem was the place to be. People had money, people were moving around. You know, black men had control of everything. Okay. They controlled the heroin trade. They controlled things. And Frank continues to make more and more money. He gets more and more involved. He gets more and more products sent to him. And, you know, really by the late 60s, Frank is handling millions of dollars of heroin. It really just went so damn quick. And Frank was literally not only supplying the streets with drugs, but he got to a point where he was literally supplying every major hub in the city and on the East Coast. And I want to make this clear, okay? Because entertainment and Hollywood would lend you to believe that Frank Lucas and Nicky Barnes and all these people were the guys. Not fucking true. Okay, frankly, Frank Lucas is a fucking liar, and that story about him is a fucking lie. Okay, Frank Matthews was the guy supplying all those people. Okay, Nicky Barnes and Frank Lucas were like corner boys compared to Frank Matthews. Frank was the connect. It's that simple. And at one point, the DA would say Frank controlled the cutting, packaging, and sale of heroin in every East Coast American city. Okay, and by we'll get into kind of how much money he was making, but he would set things up through, at least through New York in Brooklyn. He would operate two massive operations that would package, cut, and get the drugs street ready. One was at 925 Prospect Place in Brooklyn. He would call it the Ponderosa, and that was run by his trusted lieutenant, Mickey Beckwith. They also had another stash house at 101 East 56th Street, which they called the OK Corral. Both those places were, from what FBI and DA will tell you, they were heavily secured. They had gangs with machine guns guarding them, and they would have naked women in there packaging. And we've seen that in films. The buildings were reinforced. They had steel and concrete. They were heavily fortified. One individual would say it was like getting into a bank vault. It was just not going to happen. And add into the fact that they had armed guards literally guarding it. Frank was getting literally hundreds of kilos at a time. Okay. Which, when we think about it, keep in mind, when you cut it, I mean, imagine how much profit that is.
Yep.
I mean, that's like saying, like when you get 100 kilos, it's almost, once you cut it and get, you know, the agent into it, it's almost like having, you know, 1,000 kilos, right? They were cutting it with mannitol and quinine in a 32-gallon garbage can, which they used a canoe to stir. Okay. I mean, Frank was literally, the operation was absolutely gigantic. Cops at one point would find a stock of 2.5 million glassine envelopes waiting to be filled with heroin. 2.5 million envelopes. Think about that. Gigantic operation.
That is an operation the likes of which you can't fathom. I mean, when you said he's controlling every major Eastern city, that is no exaggeration. I mean, this guy is moving this product up and down the East Coast in massive quantities. And it's unbelievable to me how quickly he got this all set up.
And at one point, they would talk about they, in creating all of this, a half a pound, okay, which is a lot, yeah. Okay? A half a pound of residue was found in an abandoned garbage can. Nobody even bothered with it. Too little of an amount. Informants would also say they had seen cash stacked eye high in neat columns in a closet. And there's also a story that I think one of Frank's lieutenants talked about. I think it might have been Liddy Jones, who was from Baltimore. He was a drug buyer of Frank's. He mentioned at one point Frank loaned him $1 million, which in those times is like six.
Yep.
That's a lot of money.
Sure is.
And weeks on end went by and Jones didn't get a call. And he's thinking like, is he going to make me pay this back or what? So he calls Frank and says, hey, Frank, I get you the money back. I forgot. He goes, what are you talking about? What money? And he said, Frank didn't even remember. That's how much money he had. He didn't even think about it. $1 million was like 10 to him. So like Blackjack, if somebody takes $20 from you, you're not going to get mad about it, right? That's like what $1 million was to Frank Matthews.
It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable the amount of money this guy was dealing in.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said, it wasn't that Frank was just packaging and selling in Brooklyn or Harlem or whatever. Frank was also the connect for literally massive cities and massive organizations. So from Boston to Atlanta to New Orleans to everywhere, literally in this country that was selling drugs, it went through Frank Matthews. And at one point, the feds would say that 1/3 of the heroin between like a 5-year period touched Frank Matthews' hands, which is a staggering amount. And again, Frank's goal was to make as much money as possible and eventually fuck the Italians off with all this shit because they wouldn't deal with him. Remember, he had a vendetta, which it's almost like a Sicilian vendetta. They never forget. Frank had the vendetta as well. Some of the people that Frank controlled, keep in mind, Philadelphia was probably his biggest stronghold. And he would sell to Pop Darby, Tommy Farrington, Fat Tyrone Palmer, Major Coxon. These were all high-end drug traffickers, and they were getting everything from Frank Matthews. And Pop Darby was one of Frank's lieutenants. He was a big-timer in Frank's organization. Keep in mind, another city that was gigantic, and if you've ever seen The Wire, you've probably heard some of these names. Baltimore, very big hub for heroin. Little Melvin Williams, Liddy Jones, Big Head Brother. Big Head Brother was probably the biggest drug trafficker in Baltimore history. He was one of Frank's trusted people, okay? And again, these are guys that are gigantic in their own right. Big Head Brother was so big that he, you know, he's talked about as like a legend. He was so big that in The Wire, they didn't even have a character about him. He was just mentioned. He was that big. Like, he was so fucking powerful, and Frank was above him. And again, these guys, a lot of these guys are still alive. Liddy Jones is still alive. He'll tell you there was nobody fucking bigger than Frank. It's that simple. Nobody could bring him down. Nobody could touch him. And by this point, Frank, he's developing a family of his own. He marries Barbara Hinton, his common law wife, and they have 3 kids. By this point, Brooklyn's getting too small. And where does Frank move, Blackjack? Moves out to Todd Hill, which...
Yeah. Famous neighbor. Got a famous neighbor.
Yes, a couple famous neighbors. In fact, his next door neighbor was Paul Castellano. Tommy Lucchese lived out that way. And let's just say they weren't very happy that Frank Matthews...
No.
Because again, and you know, this isn't a secret during those times, Frank was the only black male on that street. Okay. It's that simple. And let's just be real. Okay. There was some racial issues there. Okay. Frank didn't like the Italians. Italians didn't like him. Okay. He and they all had a problem with each other. But Frank was starting to kind of develop some problems, though, in his own life. He was starting to get a little ostentatious with his money. He was, you know, spending tons of money gambling. He was, you know, developing a cocaine habit. He was driving around in Rolls Royces. He was having large parties at his home. And you know who that pissed off?
Paul Castellano.
Yeah. Okay. So again, Frank is starting to kind of have some problems here, but it didn't matter. And look, ultimately, in the early 70s, there was a problem for the Italians because the French Connection was kind of a distant memory. And Frank literally said, we don't need the fucking Italians. We're going to cut them out. We're going to go straight to Venezuela, develop a relationship with the Corsicans through France, and we're going to create our own organization. Mm-hmm. It was just that simple. And that's where Frank Matthews couldn't be touched. Okay. And some of these guys that are in Hollywood, like Frank Lucas, literally bit off his story. They bit off Pee Wee Kirkland's story. All the guys that were actually doing something, we've not seen films about. Okay. And most people that are listening to this show never heard of Frank Matthews. But again, Frank was the guy. He was above all the guys we hear about. So Frank does something as well in the early 70s that becomes a big problem. In 1971, Frank has this inquisition that he's going to become the mafia in the black underworld. He was going to create his own organization, really almost like a commission, if you will.
Yep.
You know, and if you've ever, and I always relate this, if you've ever seen The Wire, remember Black Chicken The Wire, they create the New Day Co-op, where it's like all the drug dealers in Baltimore are all working together. There's no violence. Everything works. Frank almost tries to do that himself. In 1971, he sets up a meeting in Atlanta where he invites all the major Hispanic and black drug dealers to come to Atlanta and have almost a conference, if you will, kind of similar to Appalachian or the Atlantic City conference. And the goal was to get, not have to worry about the Italians. We're going to do this on our own. We cut them out and we're the direct connection to our neighborhoods. Because for a long time, as I said, the Italians ruled the drug trade and they were ruling it in black neighborhoods as well. Frank Matthews said, fuck them. We're getting them out of here. They're controlling stuff behind the scenes. We're going to control things now, and we're going to make all the money.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very bold move to try to, you know, circumvent what at this point in 1971 is still a very powerful Italian mafia. So, you know, a bold move to try to do this. And I mean, listen, I guess if you're going to do it, the way to do it is to get everyone on the same page, right?
It's important to understand, though, and this is something that I will say time and time again. There were certain black gangsters, particularly Frank Matthews, the Philly Black Mafia, all these guys, they did what they wanted and the mob never did shit. Okay. I know simply that at one point the Black Mafia in Philadelphia did whatever they wanted. Angelo Bruta didn't do shit about it. It's that simple. And when it came to Frank Matthews, I know people are going to say that he, you know, fought the mob and maybe kind of won, but he did, hypothetically, for a certain amount of years. He went down, created his own connection, and that was that. The problem that Frank had was he was getting more and more on police radar. People were starting to find out about him. They were starting to wiretap him, and he was starting to have issues in his own organization. Some of his people were starting to get into trouble. One of his biggest connects, a guy that bought drugs off him, was a guy called Fat Tyrone Palmer. Okay. Palmer was a bon vivant, if you will, in Philadelphia. He was a big drug trafficker. He was fat. They called him Fat Ty. It's pretty simple. Now, during this time in the early 70s, not only was Harlem a place to go and party, but Atlantic City was as well. There was a black renaissance there also. The Club Harlem, I don't know if you've ever heard of that, Black Chick. It was a big time club in Atlantic City that would host, you know, singers and comedians and all sorts of black entertainers. Frank would frequent it all the time. Easter Sunday, 1972 comes. Frank Matthews is not in the building that night, but Tyrone Palmer is, along with his entourage. Fat Ty was kind of the middleman for the Black Mafia to get drugs in Philly. He reneges on a deal. Black Mafia says he's a fucking dead man. We don't care if he's involved with Frank Matthews. He's a dead man. The Black Mafia goes into Club Harlem, 800 people there. They execute 8 different people. 26 were injured as well, one of them being Fat Tyrone Palmer. Keep in mind, nothing is done about it. The Black Mafia continues to operate. Down the road, Major Coxon, who is another supplier that bought from Frank Matthews, he was also killed by the Black Mafia. That was particularly heinous. If you know anything about the Mage, the Black Mafia ran into his home in the middle of the day, killed him, killed his daughter, his eldest son, and basically eliminated everyone but two people in the house. They were particularly violent, and that's one thing Frank Matthews never did. He never dealt with the Philly Black Mafia. They were allowed with impunity to do whatever they wanted, okay? And this is where things started to happen. Philadelphia was starting to become a problem. He would bring up Pop Darby, one of his lieutenants from Philadelphia, to get out of there. And they started to develop a problem for Frank Matthews. He was also dealing with issues with the mob. At one point, Paul would say, I'm obviously not very happy that he's here. And he would talk about how Frank Matthews wasn't keeping a low profile. He threatened and sent people to tell Frank that he needs to leave Toad Hill. Frank would respond, I'll go to Mulberry Street and kill every WOP I see.
Yikes.
So Frank was a guy that was not willing to back down. But he was starting to get to a boiling point with certain people. And, you know, again, it's interesting to think about what would have happened, you know, if, you know, what happens to Frank doesn't happen. But, you know, Frank was starting to get really touchy with the Italians. And we'll get to what we all think happened to Frank Matthews, but, you know, ultimately, you know, you can't, we saw this with Galanti Blackjack. You can't fuck with them too much. Eventually they're going to come calling.
Yep. I mean, listen, they'll give you a certain amount of latitude, but, you know, in order to avoid a massive conflict, but there is a point at which you become too much of a liability, too much of a loose end, and you got to go. And Frank Matthews at this point probably was past that line.
Yeah, but again, Frank continued to do major business. Keep in mind, by 1972, the IRS would estimate that this is just in 1 year. Now, remember, this is 1972. Frank would profit $10 million, which, again, it's about 60. Okay, just in selling heroin itself. Yep. Frank was making a ton of money. He would also, in 1972, create another summit. And this was another big problem for him. Frank would hold this drug dealer summit again. He would hold it out at the Sands Hotel in a fight. There was a fight as well that weekend between Jerry Quarry and Muhammad Ali. During that time, the feds start tapping Frank's phones. They start really kind of getting into some of the discussions where Frank's talking about selling massive amounts of drugs. And the beginning of the end is coming for Frank. Keep in mind, Blackjack, as well, during all this, Frank Matthews was supplying the other drug dealers throughout the East Coast with multi-kilogram shipments. So he was getting the heroin at a discounted price, and he would sell it to them for about $26,000 per kilo. And then he was doing his own street level stuff. He would take most of his money and send it out to Las Vegas, where he would launder it at different casinos. He was taking it and investing it in other businesses. He had political connections. He was just a very rich, very powerful person that literally was bigger than the mob and the drug trade at one point.
Yeah, I mean, he absolutely was. I mean, as you said, he was supplying every major East Coast city. He was controlling most of the drugs that were touched in this country at one point, and he's making millions and millions of dollars basically in an operation that he started as a one-man deal. So, yeah, he was, you could certainly argue he was the most powerful criminal in the United States for a solid, you know, 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, and again, like, to keep overstating it, like the people that he is supplying drugs to, so like the Baltimores, the Phillies, Atlanta, these different locations, the dealers that were selling drugs that we were getting from him were gigantic. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, any of them, Fat Tyrone or Big Head Brother, these guys were like legends in their cities. This was the guy that was giving them stuff. So it's crazy to think about. I mean, it's truly wild. Things would start to fall apart, though, for Frank. After the Vegas meeting, early 1973, Frank Matthews is arrested in Vegas on charges of tax evasion and conspiracy to distribute heroin and cocaine. At that point, he goes to an FBI field office and he, quote, won't talk to anybody that's white. That was said at the meeting. He ordered that the DEA bring in a DEA agent, and they give him a $5 million bond, which at that time was the highest bail amount ever set. What was the highest bail amount you've ever seen set, Blackjack? Million?
I mean, in person, I would say $1 million. Yeah.
Okay. Now remember, that's in present time. Right. 5 million in 1973 was like 30.
Yeah.
Like, have you ever seen a $30 million bail?
No, if you're going to set that number, you might as well just deny bail.
Right. Cause it's like, no one's going to pay it.
Yeah.
Frank, would eventually get it lowered though. He would agree not to fight extradition and go back to New York. It would be cut in half. And then eventually it would be cut significantly. So they go from one extreme to the other, right?
Yep.
Frank gets his bail reduced to $325,000, which is crazy when you look back, because Frank had the resources to leave. He could have left the fucking country. He had millions of dollars. He was extremely wealthy. It almost seems like a complete failure by the FBI to do anything here.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, that decision is made by a judge, and I don't really understand setting bond at $325,000. That seems absurd to me for a guy who, you know, you would presume at the bail hearing, you had government testimony saying, like, he's profiting $10 million a year. $325,000 is a drop in the bucket. So I don't really understand it. But he certainly was able to post that.
Frank would be indicted on 6 counts of tax evasion, conspiracy to distribute heroin and cocaine. And he would face a 50-year sentence. Now, it's still kind of incredible. Okay, 1973, Blackjack. Frank is still only 29.
Yeah.
Like, he's not even 30. And he's done all this. Like, I think that's the important part of all of this. Like, he was a, like, 100 millionaire and still not even 30.
Yep.
And I remember a fascinating conversation I heard one time. The individual, the cop that arrested Frank back during when he stole chickens, okay, he was a Durham police officer. He ended up being a sergeant at one point. He commented at one point he had heard Frank Matthews was a huge drug dealer. And I think he quoted as saying, like, there's no fucking way Frank Matthews, little Frank Matthews, is that. And no one could believe it. It was truly incredible. So Frank would be, you know, face 50 years, but for him, it wasn't a life sentence. You know, 50 years in the feds, he's going to do 35. You know, he'll be out by, you know, his 60s. Frank would then get wind, though, that the feds had another indictment. They were going to supersede it, and they were going to hit Frank Blackjack with the law that kind of the kingpin statute, basically. Mm-hmm. And at the time it was called, what was it? The 828 law, I believe, where, or the 848, where it's a controlled substance act, where if you're selling an amount of drugs over a certain amount, like 100
yep.
million or whatever it was, you would be a mandatory life sentence. Like, right away, you're done. That's that. And Frank got wind that they were possibly going to give him that lifer sentence. And that's when Frank jumps bail. Okay. On July 2nd, 1973, Frank is scheduled to appear in a Brooklyn court, but he never shows up. Now, around this time and down the road, the feds would bust the rest of the organization. People like Big Head Brother, people like that were in Frank's organization. I think it was in 1975, they all got busted. And a lot of these guys, Liddy Jones, Big Head Brother, all these guys that bought from Frank would get long prison sentences, 20, 30 years. None would jump. They'd all go to prison and they would eventually get out. And something's interesting happens as well during all this. Frank's connects in Venezuela get jammed up as well. And for whatever reason, Rolando Gonzalez, there was said that he was a connected CIA person because he would end up years later retiring and just getting out of the business. So a lot of people wonder, was Frank, were all these people somewhat connected in the American CIA somehow? I guess we can wonder about that. But let's kind of get to what happened with Frank. Frank would literally disappear. Okay. He would take, from people, what people said, about $20 million, which at the time is about $100 million. He was last seen in Brooklyn. According to the police, they spotted him in Brooklyn. They gave chase and lost him. He was last seen also in Durham, North Carolina, where he had safety deposit boxes. According to the banks, they were all cleaned out. He would grab his girlfriend, Cheryl Brown, and he would disappear. He was seen boarding, from what people said, a private plane in Houston, Texas. Keep in mind, he left his family, his kids, everybody. And which is crazy, to this day, Frank Matthews has never been seen again. Tips have been reported in six continents. People have claimed to have seen him in the Bahamas, Asia, Africa, Curacao, the Americas, in Houston. The feds have said at one point Frank had developed a cocaine dependence and that he had a heart problem. And that, quote, he went to Houston to have a heart transplant. People have said they've seen him in Durham. There was a situation one time where Frank had some family issues, and assuming they thought he'd go back to Durham, he never showed up. But interestingly enough, the feds actually bugged the phone of Cheryl Brown, his girlfriend. They bugged her parents' phone because this was a girl that obviously was a normal girl. You would think she'd have called home. For 5 years after the disappearance of Frank Matthews, they never contacted her. She never contacted her parents. But something was found a few years ago. A year after the disappearance, Cheryl Brown's parents visited Curacao, weirdly enough. And if you know where Curacao is, it's very close to Venezuela. So to this day, Frank Matthews is the most wanted fugitive in this country. Now, he's no longer on the most wanted list. And I want to kind of ask you, do you think, keep in mind, Frank Matthews at this day would be 77 years old. If you talk to FBI agents, the ones that covered and were going after Frank Matthews, they'll tell you that he's alive. And frankly, a lot of them will. You know, most of the people will tell you, I think he's alive. He had tons of money. He could have blended right in. There were reports that he was seen, and they were curated, that he was in the Bahamas. But it's conceivable to think, Blackjack, he could very much blend into any of the African areas, obviously in the Bahamas, in the Caribbean. Where do you think Frank Matthews is?
I think that Frank Matthews is probably in South America somewhere. I think that with the amount of money he had, the connections that he had, I think the safest place for him to go is South America. Also, we don't have an extradition treaty with Venezuela. I'm sure he probably knew about that or became aware of it at some point. I think the stories about him being seen in America are crazy. I don't think there's any way this dude is in the United States. I think South America is the landing spot, right? If you've got 20 million bucks and you've got strong connections with the cartel and you've got people you know down there, you could probably go and make a nice little life for yourself.
Now, look, the likelihood of us ever knowing what happened to Frank Matthews will largely be, it will never happen, okay? And it is conceivable that Frank Matthews died.
Sure. I mean, listen, he'd be an old man now, and let's be honest, Jeff, he did have a pretty bad drug problem.
But again, I mean, the thing is, most states, most countries in the world would have fingerprints. If it was a natural death, his body would have been recovered. Could the mafia have killed him? Maybe, where he's in like a Jimmy Hoffa situation now. But I want to bring something up that the great Al Proffitt talked about. And Al Proffitt is a filmmaker in Detroit. He did a terrific film on Frank Matthews, and he mentioned something in a recent video he did, I think 2 years ago, about Frank Matthews. And this is interesting. There was an individual in Baltimore Blackjack called Shorty Boyce. Now, Shorty Boyce was a gambler. He was a big-time numbers guy, and he was a self-proclaimed hustler. He knew Frank Matthews. And I think if you read between the lines, probably connected a lot of Baltimore people to Frank Matthews. He was one of these guys that was always in the streets. He died, I want to say, in 2017. They had a large funeral in Baltimore City for Shorty Boys. And they reported that the FBI was putting up wanted posters, trying to talk to people at the funeral. Why would they do that if they believed Frank Matthews was dead?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they would, you know, unless they're just trying to cover their bases and tie up a loose end. I mean, I don't know. But I think you're right that they probably believe he's alive. Now, whether that's based on, you know, conjecture or real evidence, I don't know. But like I said, if I had to guess, I would say that Frank Matthews beat a path to South America and has probably stayed there.
The old adage that you beat the government and got away with it really doesn't apply to anyone outside of Tony Accardo that we know.
No, it doesn't. I mean,
Frank Matthews is the guy that got away with it. Let's ask ourselves, you're a lawyer, Blackjack. Let's say Frank Matthews went to Quantico and walked into the FBI building and said, "You've been looking for me for 48 years. Here I am." What the hell could they get him on?
I mean,
seriously, well, outside of like bail jumping, literally everyone involved has died. There's no case files, as far as I know, from this.
No, these cases get stale. I mean, your law enforcement agents, in large part, are probably dead. Your witnesses are all dead. The evidence itself is probably just gone. I mean, yeah, you'd get him. You'd get him on jumping bail. You'd get him on contempt of court. I mean, you know, and listen, they're going to max him on anything they can. But no, the drug charges, they're stale at this point.
I mean, Frank Matthews has been on the run since 1973. Think about that. 48 years, 2 months, and 10 days. He has been on the run. And he has never been seen. And he has never – I mean, even – but again, I think when you look at it, like comparing it to like Whitey Bulger's ridiculous because, I mean, he makes Whitey Bulger look like a fucking, you know, nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy had $100 million when he left.
Yeah. And he left with 20 of it, which is still a fortune to leave with. And I mean, but that's why I'm saying, Jeff, like if you're, you know, like I know what you alluded to there, the stories about, you know, maybe the mob had him taken out, maybe this, maybe that. I think that if you're going to do this move, you know, with the amount of money that he was paying to, you know, his suppliers in South America, he probably had a soft landing for him there. And like I said, there's no extradition out of Venezuela. So, you know, if you're going to go somewhere, that's the place that makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about. Frank Matthews is, I don't know how else you could say other than a legend, frankly. He beat the government, got away with it. And I think they could do anything and everything. And they couldn't, they won't find him. If I had to guess, I think he's in Curacao personally, or like you said, Venezuela. And you know, Venezuela is a whole lot different of a country than it was then, but
sure.
You know, Frank Matthews could be in Africa. I mean, I know Zimbabwe, they don't have a extradition treaty. You know, the Comoros are beautiful. You know, Mauritania, Tunisia. And there's all sorts of countries that Frank Matthews could be in. I definitely believe he's still alive. And, you know, it's funny because there's one thing about Frank Matthews that I didn't talk about. Well, I did talk about it briefly. They mentioned that Frank had a cocaine dependence, which according to people that knew Frank Matthews, nobody had ever seen him directly do cocaine. Frank also was known to, quote, love blonde women. There you go.
Who doesn't?
Exactly. Also wanted to mention, Frank Matthews obviously had three children, and his wife, Barbara Hinton, would actually eventually get jammed up when the crew went down. She would actually get exonerated, though, years later. But his family, from what I understand, they're grown men at this point, obviously. I know one of Frank's son had a law issue in Ohio, I believe. No one came calling. Frank didn't come calling. I guess he left him a good amount of money, but a fascinating individual. We'll never know what happened to Frank Matthews, but fascinating nonetheless. He truly beat the government and got away with it. And when you think back to the glorious time that Harlem had and New York had, you know, the guys you see in the movies, they're just movies. Frank Matthews was the big timer. He was the guy. And from an American standpoint, someone born here that controlled the drug trade, there was nobody bigger. It's that simple. So there you go. Frank Matthews on the sit down. So you think he's alive?
I think there's a good chance he's alive.
Think he would talk to us?
No.
I'll tell you what. Shout out to people like Scott Bernstein. Scott, if you can get him to talk to you, that'll get you 50 million views.
Yeah, sure will.
Maybe Vlad TV will talk to him.
Yeah, maybe.
It's like, there you go. Fascinating, nonetheless. Next week, we got another episode. I think we're going to do, and we're going to go a little bit different way again with the show. Football starts, NFL starts. I think we're going to do Joe Mastronardo. And the reason for that is a lot. He was probably one of the biggest bookmakers in the history of America. He once told Nicky Scarfa to go fuck himself. And he literally ruled the gambling business in America. It's that simple. He made lines. He controlled things. And the mob never really touched him. So maybe we'll talk about him. I don't know where we'll go with the show next week. But, you know, we'll always have a great episode. Blackjack, I know you're going out to Vegas, aren't you?
I sure am, flying out Friday.
Nice. Looking forward to that, I'm sure.
Yep.
Good stuff. We also have an announcement coming up that we'll make. It's really our goal. Our goal was always to get this show to one height, to another height, to another height. And that's really how kind of things work in the business that we're in. You know, the goal is obviously to create a show. Then it's to get people to listen to it. Then it's to try to create revenue streams off of it. And we're at the point now where we can create revenue streams off what we're doing. So we're going to start partnering with a new company, and they're going to take us to another level and then another level, hopefully, and so on. So we're getting there, Blackjack, with the sit down.
Sure are. It's going to be a really exciting announcement when we make it. I'm looking forward to it.
So we all will ask is that you follow us on Twitter at the sit down 7. I get people every day that, hey, I just found your show. I think it's great. I appreciate that. Make sure if you're enjoying what Blackjack and I are doing, leave us a comment, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Go support our sponsors, whether it's Thrive Fantasy, whether it's Omerta, whether it's a sponsor to be named. Support these groups, because that's how you keep our show going. That's how you keep media going. And you don't have to pay for this show, so that's how you keep it going. As always, we appreciate you listening. I am the big man on campus, Jeff Nadeau. He is Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.